Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer, journalist, author, and historian of 20th century popular culture, Elizabeth J. Rosenthal. And we're continuing our conversation about her new book, Gene Krupa, and the Music He Gave the World. Liz, welcome back to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book again.
Thank you, Mark. I'm excited to be here again.
Yeah, you know, it's just a great biography, and we're going to be talking about his later life. But first, you have an extraordinary chapter in this book that just really took me by surprise. It was about Gene and rock music.
Right. Yes.
And you had one of the Stray Cats write the introduction to your book.
That's true. Although I have to give credit to my editor, he recruited the drummer from the Stray Cats, Slim Jim Phantom.
Well, do you know that one of the first places they played in the United States after they had been to Britain was here at WICN?
I did not know that.
Yeah, they played a concert for us in Worcester, and there's some great photographs of me with the band.
Wow!
But this was an extraordinary chapter for a lot of reasons. First of all, Gene wasn't really fond of rock music. Why?
Well, it's not that he wasn't fond. He really, really didn't like it. And the reason why, I mean, I think what he said was that he thought that the beats in rock and roll were too simplistic. And also, this is kind of a funny thing for him to say, that the drumming was too loud. But
for him to say that is something else.
Yes, but he said that they were too loud, and the reason was because they had to play that way in order to be heard over the electric guitars.
Well, and we should mention to the audience that that was one of the big complaints about Gene is that it was playing too loud.
Yeah. I don't know if he was thinking that they played even louder than he did or what. But, you know, I think with him, he was so devoted to jazz, which is was his first love, going back to his teenage years. And I think that he, I think was probably, in fact, I know he was disturbed by the fact that the popularity of jazz was just plummeting.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and a lot of his fellow jazzers were starting to have trouble getting work. And again, this was jazz was a language for him that he in part created. So, I mean, it's possible that if he had lived longer, he might have softened over time, but that's the way it was then.
Now, what's extraordinary, Liz, about your book is you then follow this with this enormous list of rock drummers who cite Gene Krupa as their major influence and inspiration.
Yeah, I was pretty amazed myself. I thought, wow, because it seems like he doesn't get credit for that. He doesn't get credit for essentially being an early influence, if you will, on rock music. It's not just the drummers. It's surf music.
And even
punk rock.
Well, I just want to run through some of the things, some of the people mentioned. I mean,
yeah.
A lot of it had to do with a movie, which we haven't talked about yet, the Gene Krupa story, which was drum crazy in Britain.
Yeah.
That movie, which he played himself.
He played the music himself, yes.
But that was, a lot of people saw that and saw the performance aspect of it and were really blown away. Keith Moon.
Yes.
Of The Who is a good example. Steve Smith of Journey, Peter Criss from Kiss, Bob Elliott from The Hollies, Mickey Hart from The Grateful Dead. The list is in your book is just wild.
And Danny Sarafine.
Yeah.
Chicago. And Corky Lang from Mountain.
I mean.
So,
I mean, how do you explain? I mean, what was that movie sounded like? It was very influential.
Well, it was. Now, the movie itself was not so great. I mean, it was okay as entertainment. Unfortunately, it was a very rather bereft on accurate, you know, details or facts. But the music, he played it. You know, he played the whole soundtrack, and you hear it throughout the movie, and it is the best thing about the movie. And I think anybody who either was interested in drums or who was susceptible to be interested in drums had to take notice, and they did. And you know, that included Keith Moon and I think John Bonham. Now, I think he actually saw other movies that Gene was actually in that he was inspired by. Yeah, you could just go on and on and on about the different drummers who they either saw that movie or heard Sing, Sing, Sing as they were growing up and it was played in their house, or or it's just filtered down to them. It's hard to say. It's not hard to say, but I mean, there are all these different ways that his drumming his drumming was an inspiration to them.
I think one of the great things about the book, and people are going to have to read this, is you also specifically talk about pieces, rock pieces, that where you can hear the influence of Gene Krupa.
Yeah.
That's just, but let's get back to Gene. Gene at 50, he's getting down towards the latter third of his life here. At 50 right. years old, he's still vigorous. He's still athletic. You write it that he loves to take icy baths, which is big.
He likes to swim in icy water.
Geez, that's become such a big thing now.
maybe he was an influence on that trend too. Who knows?
But the problem was he smoked like an engine. He smoked constantly.
Yes.
And so he had a heart attack November 1960.
Yes.
And what did the doctors tell him?
Well, they told him to take it easy. or if he's going to play maybe no more than 18 weeks out of the entire year. And very initially he abided by that, but within maybe a year or two, he started, you know, going farther and farther afield, adding more and more dates, and pretty soon he was pretty much working, you know, most of the year. He couldn't not do it. I mean, it was his whole life, really. You know, it may not have really, I guess it mattered, but because he was never the same, I mean, Even in the time leading up to his heart attack, he was starting to notice that maybe he didn't quite have the vigor or stamina to do what he had done just a few years earlier. That's the way he felt. And then afterward, that was certainly the case after the heart attack. But he kept going, and he sounded great. He sounded great when he played. Everybody loved him, everybody who saw him. He performed a lot on television. That created a lot of notice.
You write about when he was on the Johnny Carson show, and he put on a typical Gene Krupa, you know, display of incredible drum talent.
Yes.
But he was noticeably winded.
Yes.
After that performance, and he actually made a remark about it to Johnny Carson.
Yes, he did, and that was a little shocking. I think that was in possibly 1962. That was a little shocking because I don't know if he'd ever said that before in public.
I know.
You know, that he was winded or tired. It was a great performance. I think it might have been Caravan, the song Caravan by Duke Ellington, although I would say don't, you know, quote, well, not, you can quote me on it, but anyway, it was a very, very involved and especially impressive performance. And, yeah, he came off the stand, went to see Johnny, and he could barely catch his breath. And, And so that was definitely disturbing. And it might have been a first indication of the emphysema that he developed or that he was diagnosed with in 1967.
Well, in among this, he gets married and adopts two children.
Right. That he got married in 1959, and in 1963, and then a couple of years later, he and his wife adopted two babies through Catholic Charities. And so he was finally a father, which he had always wanted to be. And he was totally enthralled with fatherhood. And, I mean, so that was the other thing, is he was still traveling around, but he had a family now, a growing family. He did try to fly back home as often as he could, whenever he had some time off, to make sure he could spend time with them. But he just loved fatherhood so much. And then when he had to retire, and that was when he was diagnosed with emphysema in 1967, he said, that's it, I'm retiring. But the good thing about it was then he really got to spend a lot of time with his kids.
Well, he ends up getting divorced from Patty when he catches her at home with his horse racing bookie, which sounds really classic. But it was an amicable separation.
It was, thank goodness. And, they shared the children in terms of custody very, sort of freely. In other words, there was no hard and fast schedule or anything like that. there are ways that she was involved. I don't know if I don't want to get ahead of myself about what happened in 1973. There was a fire. I don't know if you want to get ahead
of myself. No, because there's stuff to talk about before then.
Okay. All right.
Now, he's living in Yonkers, and his home becomes a mecca for drummers.
Yes.
People just drop by, and he's always up for talking to people.
Yeah. Yeah, you would think that maybe he would get a little tired of it or just not want to be bothered, especially after he retired. And just, I mean, on the one hand, okay, he was retired, so he would have more time. But on the other hand, he wasn't feeling so great. But the thing is, he loved, that's one thing besides his drumming, he loved people. He loved to meet them. He loved to make new friends. He loved to mentor young drummers, or even kids who weren't drummers, just mentor them as, father and son kind of relationship. And so it is kind of remarkable. And they could just knock on his door, and he would open the door.
That's the part I found really amazing, that there is this world-renowned drummer, and you could just cold walk up to his house and knock on the door.
Yes.
And he'd open the door and welcome you in.
Right. There were times a little later in Gene's marriage to Patty where there was a bit of tension. And, for example, one of Gene's young neighbors, Joe Vetrano, who was then 16, was able to say hello, but he could tell that first they were leaving to go to a funeral, but there seemed to be some tension. So it wasn't actually until Gene had got his divorce that he was literally just invited over, and he became a sidekick.
Well, he sort of copied many aspects of Gene's life.
Yes, he did. That was cute.
That's so sort of weird.
He wore the same cologne. He used the same wallpaper. He got a similar kind of a pocket watch. It wasn't necessarily the same because it would have been too expensive. And he was, of course, he himself at the time was playing jazz as a young person, and so was influenced by Gene's drumming and Gene's interactions with young people, the encouraging interactions that he had. That was always an inspiration to Joe Vetrano, but also to others. Just the very fact that Gene was so welcoming and to people, he had humility. He had a lot of humility, and so he lack the obvious ego, at least, you know, outwardly. It didn't appear that he had an ego.
I know. It was amazing. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer, journalist, author, and historian of 20th century popular culture, Elizabeth J. Rosenthal. And we're talking about her recent biography, The Master of Drums, Gene Krupa and the Music He Gave the World. There's so many interesting details in your book, too.
Yeah.
He never wore jeans or shorts.
Right.
What did he wear?
He wore really nice clothing. He always kind of dressed for as if he were going out somewhere. You know, nice pressed pants, nice dress shirt. I guess, as far as I can tell, he just preferred dressing that way. I guess he sort of, over the decades, you know, that's how he dressed, or he learned to dress that way, and he just never gave it up. And you wouldn't think, I mean, obviously, you know, when you think about his influences like Keith Moon or so many others, where they went totally nuts on the drums, but they also kind of looked nutty,
Well, they looked rockish.
They look rockish with a lot of hair and very informal gear.
Yeah, but he always dressed like he was ready for a meeting.
Yeah, or ready for a classical recital or something.
Now, I found it wild that he continued drumming lessons.
Yeah.
Why would he do drumming lessons?
Well, you mean that he took drumming lessons?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean? Yeah, I mean, he did give them, but he especially had drumming lessons for himself. And he felt that there was always something new to learn. And it is remarkable, and it apparently helps him. But I think what really mattered probably was just the interaction with fellow drummers about the drums. And he might have gotten new ideas from them, or there might have been something he forgot about that he used to do on the drums, and then he was reminded of it, the camaraderie.
Wow.
And the enjoyment of doing it. Although, yeah, but they were technically lessons, and he got lessons. From people who he had given lessons to.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah. So 1970, he feels ready to go back to work more regularly.
Yes.
But it seems like one other thing always just keeps piling on Gene's life.
Yes.
He develops back problems from a freak accident pitching for his softball team.
Yes, right. That was terrible.
Well, wait a minute. So he's had all this other stuff, and he's pitching for a softball team.
I know. His emphysema was, being controlled by the medication he was taking.
Okay.
Although I think earlier in the day it was pretty bad, but in general. But yes, it was kept under control by medication, and so he was playing softball, which is another love of his. Baseball always a huge thing for him from the time he was a boy. And most of the time that he lived in Yonkers, he had some kind of a softball team.
Wow.
So, yeah. And
he's also still smoking.
Oh, yeah, of course. Right.
Now, he's in constant pain from the back problem. He's got, he's had a heart attack. He's got emphysema. He's in constant pain. There's no relief. But he resumes a lighter schedule of playing. This is where your biography starts sounding made up. He performs with Lionel Hampton. There's a performance at the New School for Social Research. There was actually a LP that came out of that called Jazz at the New School.
Yeah.
1972, he's nominated for the Downbeat Hall of Fame.
Yep.
And so stuff just keeps going on. 1973, he's diagnosed with leukemia.
Yeah.
And this is where it goes from bad to worse, because the den in his beloved place in Yonkers catches fire.
Right. And the strange thing, it was just the den, and that's where he had all his valuable things, everything that chronicled his career, all the music arrangements, photos, trophies, you know, everything that concerned his career. And it all went up in smoke, literally and figuratively. Again, very strange that it was that fire was limited to the den. It's just very freaky. I mean, he did have some smoke damage elsewhere in the house, but that was about it. It was really, really terrible. His friends were trying to maybe gather some things that he had lost. I mean, maybe other people had some pieces of memorabilia or even some arrangements or anything that could replenish what he lost. And they even advertised in Downbeat to that effect. But by the time they did that, I mean, he was pretty much on his last leg.
Well, as you write in your book, his friends were really had realized at that point that he's not going to be around much longer. Yet,
yeah.
1973, the original Benny Goodman Quartet had a concert at Carnegie Hall, and he played in that.
Yeah, they actually had a series of concerts started in 1972, sort of tentatively, and then in 1973, there were several concerts in different parts of the country, including Chicago and Saratoga Springs and New York and one or two other places. But yes, he did those, and he said he did those for the old man being Benny Goodman, who was 6 months younger than Gene, or 5 months younger. that was another kind of a, just as an aside, in jazz, you know, whoever was the boss was the old man. It had nothing to do with whether they were really old or not, or whether they were older than you. So that's what he said, though. He was doing it for the old man, playing in the quartet. But not that he didn't really enjoy it, because he did, but it was so difficult, because by the time he started doing this, I mean, he had gotten to the point where he was only playing maybe one or two times a month at the maximum, because he just couldn't do it. He couldn't play regular gigs as like he used to. Between all his different health problems and then the extreme pain he still had. He had back surgery, which actually I'm not exactly sure, but it may have made it worse, because he was just in excruciating pain for the rest of his life.
And for the Benny Goodman Quartet at Carnegie Hall concert in 1973, he couldn't stand up.
Right. Yeah, I think that was in June 1973, and it actually might have been the first of several reunion shows that year. So there was an encore, and normally when you have an encore, you leave the stage and then you come back. But Gene could not get up from his drums.
Wow.
So everybody else went off stage and he stayed, and then they came back. And, you know, he said, oh, everybody must have thought I was nuts. What? I could not get up. I could not stand up.
Wow.
It was so, you know, it took so much out of him.
But he was still playing.
Yes, he was still playing, and that's remarkable. But I'll tell you what, he was seen afterwards being carried out through the stage door into a limousine, wrapped in towels, because he always sweated a lot when he performed, too. But he had to be carried out and placed in a you know, limousine. And he still had at least two other shows that he did that summer.
So he definitely went down drumming.
You know, you're right. You're absolutely right. He only stopped, I think, in August would have been his last time drumming. He stopped when he literally, really just could not manage it anymore, period.
In your book, you have quotes from people who actually saw him and were shocked at how old and frail he looked up behind, not behind the drums. And it was amazing because he died that year, October 16th, 1973, I think.
Yes.
And when he did, he was 64 years old. Mm-hmm. He weighed just 112 pounds.
Right.
So that, not too long before that, he was still drumming.
Yeah. Well, you know, the leukemia obviously did him in. I mean, ultimately, his heart gave in, but the leukemia was obviously the main cause.
Wow.
And of his death. And it was really a terrible, rough year. Probably the worst year, probably since 1943, when he was busted for marijuana. But the good thing was that, you know, his friends sort of they were always rallying around him anyway, because they loved him. But you know, they made sure that he knew that they appreciated him and loved him. And
we're completely out of time.
Oh, okay.
This is an amazing biography. My guest tonight is writer, journalist, author, and historian of 20th century popular culture, Elizabeth J. Rosenthal. And we've been talking about her book, The Master of Drums, Gene Krupa and the Music He Gave the World. Liz, it's been a real pleasure.
Me too. I'm so glad you had me on again. I love it. You're a great host.
Write another book, Liz.
Okay. I'll have to see. You know, I need a little time off.
We'll talk about it off mic. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.